Hello and welcome to Faithfully Memphis. This is Reverend Paul McLean, Associate Priest of Calvary Episcopal Church in downtown Memphis. Calvary is one of the oldest churches in the Episcopal Diocese of West Tennessee. Every Thursday at 8 a.m., we have the opportunity to speak with interesting people and learn about the role that faith plays in their lives. In a few minutes, I'll be talking with Bill Craddock, author of Restreaming, Thriving in the Currents of Retirement. We are broadcast from WYXR 91.7 FM in Memphis, Tennessee. But first, I want to let you know that 2 days ago, on September 14th, we celebrated a major feast day in the life of the church, Holy Cross Day. It is one of the few, if not only, feast days in which we celebrate an object rather than a person or an event. We don't know, or at least I don't know, where the actual cross of Jesus is. I'll leave the search and retrieval of it to Dr. Indiana Jones. We do know that during excavations directed by Empress Helena in the 4th century, a relic believed to be that of the true cross was discovered. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem was built around this site, believed to be Golgotha, or the Hill of Calvary. It was dedicated on September 14th in the year 335, which is why we celebrate Holy Cross Day this week. As you can imagine, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is one of the must-see sites for pilgrims to the Holy Land. I made such a pilgrimage in 2009. Near the end of our time in Jerusalem, we all got up at 5 o'clock one morning to walk the Stations of the Cross along the Via Dolorosa. It is the old street in Jerusalem that is remembered as the path that Jesus took to his crucifixion site at Calvary, now the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Via Dolorosa is Latin for the way of suffering. The reason we got up so early is the street becomes crowded and busy later in the day because it is the center of the marketplace of the old city of Jerusalem. We wanted time and space to pray, offer our devotional, and sing an anthem at each station. There was still daily marketplace activity going on even at that early hour. People were carrying goods and setting up their shops, much like the activities that would have taken place as Jesus made his walk with the cross on the Via Dolorosa. We pilgrims took turns carrying a large olive wood cross that was still much smaller and less burdensome than the cross Jesus carried. At the fifth station, I was handed the cross to carry. Along the way to the next station, we encountered a very old Palestinian man who was pushing a heavy cart up a hilly cross street. His face was wrinkled and weather-beaten, and he grimaced and groaned as he pushed the cart with all his might to try and get it up the hill. And when I saw him, there was an impulse within me to lay down the cross, leave the group, and go help this old man push this cart up the hill. Several of the pilgrims later shared that they too saw this man and felt the same impulse. But we had all been instructed to stay with the group and stay in the moment, so we didn't go help him. Looking back, I regret that I didn't color outside the lines, put down the cross, and go up and push the cart. The old man, after much effort, did get his cart up the hill all by himself. When I think back on our walk that day, the image of his grimaced face and the sound of his groan come back to me vividly. A number of years ago, there was a television show called Joan of Arcadia. It was about a teenage girl who encountered God in the form of different human beings, ranging from a garbage man to a little girl ballerina. The show began with the song, "What if God was one of us, just a stranger on a bus?" In Jesus, we know that God was, is, and always will be one of us. Jesus is God entering our humanity. He feels real pain, and he grimaces, groans, and struggles with his and our very real burdens. I can only imagine all the suffering he has felt during this past year of sorrows. Jesus does carry our burdens and challenges us to carry and lift up the burdens of others. I will always wonder if there's a deeper reason that God revealed to me on the Via Dolorosa, a weather-beaten old man pushing a cart up a hill. I am pleased that Bill Craddock is our guest today. He is a Calvary parishioner and a guide about wellness, and lots of other things, although he's probably too humble to say that. And he's the author of Restreaming, Thriving in the Currents of Retirement. Bill, I won't ask you how you got to Memphis, since you've been here a long time, but I will ask you to tell us about your life pilgrimage so far and name some of the mile markers you've discovered or planted on your way. In the spirit of the Tom T. Hall metaphor, tell us how Bill Craddock got to be who Bill Craddock is now.
Thank you, Paul. You know, you mentioned the Holy Cross and the day of the Holy Cross, and frankly, September 14th is my birthday.
Oh, I forgot that. Happy belated birthday.
Right. And someone once said that you must have been born at an early age. And I guess I was. But I do celebrate September 14th quietly, particularly now that I'm north of 70 by a few years. But yes, I was born in Memphis and raised in Memphis and went to a public high school called Central High School. And when I was younger, I guess I was provincially challenged because I didn't travel very much, but I was naive and enthusiastic and burdened with curiosity. And I went off to college, found a wonderful lady who I'm still married to, and then moved to New York City and then back down to Memphis, and have been in Memphis now for 54 years, living in Midtown. And it's been a wonderful experience. Memphis has a lot of soul, and it's been a place that we call home, and so have our three lovely daughters who grew up in Memphis call home, and now we have seven grandchildren, too. When I was out of college at my age, it seemed to me that I was directed to get ahead, and so when I got back to Memphis, I did what was probably predictable. I bought a station wagon, I bought a house, I got a mortgage, started having children, starting to build a career, and trying to get ahead to be successful. And at about age 40, it all seemed to be working very well. Everything clicked together, a successful business, a wonderful family, a great place in Midtown to live. Everybody seemed to be happy. Except I started asking the questions, well, am I here to make money or make meaning? Am I here to get ahead and to be successful or to make a difference in other people's lives? And I was going to Calvary Church and attended a program called Education for Ministry. And it seemed to me, and I know we all look back at markers, but that one turned my head. And instead of being a money maker, I wanted to be a meaning maker. And it really took me about 3 or 4 years to figure out how to do that. I'd been very active with the church, but I didn't think I wanted to be a parish priest. So 5 years later, I left the business world and became active with the National Episcopal Church in various roles as a consultant. And that evolved into work with the church pension fund, where I was involved for close to 20 years, guiding Episcopal clergy through various wellness programs. And it's been a wonderful journey. I retired about six, seven years ago. And that was also, I guess, a marker we have. It seems to be that when you look back on your life, you're always trying to make sense of it in terms of the decisions you make. But the decisions you make sometime are not necessarily hard stop decisions, but more or less being pulled along. And I think of the word vocation not as a calling, but a being pulled along and drawn towards something new, something that is evolving, something that's creative, that really inspires me and gives me a sense of a place, a sense of being, a sense of meaning and purpose in life. So it's been a journey that I guess you would call it quixotic, but I would call it a wonderful journey. And Paul, you mentioned the word Via Dolorosa. Gosh, I hope my way has not been a way totally of pain, although we have bitterness and different things that happen to us, but it's been a road of joy. And I'm feeling very grateful for the life that I've been given.
Wonderful. Well, I can attest to that from being how much you nourish friendships along the way. And we'll talk probably more about that as we move along. And we have also talked some about, the so-called life stages. And, that I know that different scholars, different people look at life and as a series of stages. I think we both agree that they tend to be more permeable and free-flowing if they do exist rather than concrete or stationary. Tell us where you are on thinking about life stages.
Well, I think all of us look back on life and try to have markers, as I said, of what the stages of life are. But the psychologist Erik Erikson certainly has a set of categories that you can follow. Carl Jung comes up with the concept of the puer or teenus, the eternal, the young boy who evolves into the hero or the warrior, who evolves into the father, the paternal, who evolves eventually into the wisdom person or the keeper of wisdom. And in some ways, we all, through our life stages, sometimes discover that we're moving into a different state and we don't even know it was there. It is fluid. And just like life as a journey, the stages of life aren't marked like the boundaries of a state as you pass from one to the next or from one county line to the next. It just happens to be. And suddenly you're in astonishment when you realize that you're in a different stage.
Yeah, I've faced that too. And I remember in our 20s, 30s, and maybe even in our 40s, we are at least we're in sort of an achievement phase and we're looking at projects, achievements, things, as David Brooks would put it, we're in the resume building phase. And he later talks about the eulogy virtue phase, where these are things that you maybe cannot quantify or look at concrete achievements, but think about some of the qualities, some of the things that we invest in other people. And I think it's interesting, around age 50, I felt like I was making a turn more to at least seeking out to live eulogy virtues rather than resume virtues. Do you find that common? And maybe does that resonate with your own journey?
Oh, I hope so. Matter of fact, here's a great story. It's not mine, but I walked into on Central Avenue. There's a hotel that Kimmins Wilson. It's called the Holiday Inn. It's across the University of Memphis. I can't remember what the title is. It's a conference center. And I walked in there as it was being built. And on the mezzanine floor is a wall of memorabilia of Kimmins Wilson, who started the Holiday Inn, as we know. And as I was walking through there, I noticed there was this man in a wheelchair with an attendant going from each of these pictures, and it happened to be Mr. Wilson. And I knew his sons, and so I walked up there and said, "Mr. Wilson, this is just wonderful. You've got so many things on the wall. Aren't you proud of this?" And he looked me right in the eye and said, "Son, this is not why I'm happy. I'm joyful because I have a good family, I have great friends, and I have trust in my God, and that's what's given me life. All of these successes are not what's important." And you think about legacy, I think that's important to realize that at the end, it's all about relationship. It's not about what you've accomplished or how many books you've written or medals or whatever. It's not about trappings and things. It's about relationships. You're right, Paul.
Yeah, you and I have talked some about this Harvard study of adult development findings that were published by George. Am I saying this right? Volant, Aging Well, and tell us how these right findings have influenced the way you live and maybe the way you've written about different life stages.
Yeah, well, George Volant wrote about a Harvard study that was begun, I think, about 1925. It's over almost 100 years old, where they tracked the students, these men students at Harvard, from the time of their their college years all the way through their life. And then the study was enhanced or added by adding women and also some workers. So it was about a $25 million study that has been going on now since, gosh, almost 90 years. And what they discovered was, in terms of who aged well, it wasn't the most successful businessmen. It wasn't those that were the greatest athletes. It wasn't those that were the most popular in terms of successes. It was those who had relationships, and relationships throughout their life. And it might be as simple as a bridge club or a golf club or a book club or an active in their church. But those that were in relationship were happier, were more engaging in life, and seem to have much more of a grasp on purpose and meaning. And I think that really kind of boils down to the importance I see is that the older I get, the more I value, cherish, and hold on to relationships, whether they be new friends or younger than I or older friends. Keeping up with those kinds of relationships really makes a difference in one's life.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the things you talked about in your book is a rhythm of REP. And tell us all what REP is.
Oh, you know, sometimes we have to use acronyms so we can remember things. But I think REP to me is my secret sauce for well-being. R is relationships, and I mentioned that. E is for exercise, and that is being active and moving around and taking care of your body, but also taking care of your mind through good exercise. And then P is purpose, having a purpose in life, engaging in others in a meaningful way. And somehow or another, that can even make a difference in someone else's life. I think that's important. So relationship, exercise, and purpose would be my North Star, my guidepost in terms of working out what we call on this pilgrimage that we're on.
Oh, wonderful. And and let's go back to the book on a macro level. Why did you write this book? What spurred you on to do this? And why did you write it in the style you did? It's not really, you know, a chapter academic book. It's more of a series of personal vignettes.
Well, as I was moving into what we call retirement, I heard so many people say, oh, you can't retire, you'll be bored, or you can't retire, your wife will not let you make sure you go away to have lunch, and all these silly things. And I started doing a lot of reading, psychological work from Jung all the way through a lot of fiction from various writers and studies that had been done, and realized that maybe there's a way to reflect on one's life that can engage and enhance one's place of being as they are now. And so the church publishing company asked me to write a book, and I kind of steered away from self-help books. I don't like those. And academic books have a very limited audience. I wanted something that would be practical, accessible, and relevant to one's life. And so I decided I would write just a series of vignettes. And that way, there are different, you could look at life in different lenses, whether it be relationships, exercise, purpose, but also gratitude, hope, pilgrimage, a lot of different ways of looking at contemplation, radical amazement, a lot of different ways of lens of looking at the world. And maybe if someone read some of these reflections, they could then in some ways capture the echo or the spirit and reflect on it on their own life.
And why did you select a kayak as the guiding metaphor for the book? And by the way, a kayak is on the cover, and it was drawn by your daughter, Maisie, and who does illustrations throughout the book. So the book is very much a family affair. But tell us about the kayak. Why that was so important to you?
Well, I think to understand, it's sometimes we need a handle. We need a metaphor. And maybe a very useful metaphor is to imagine oneself canoeing upstream with a paddle. And if you ever paddle a canoe, you have to paddle on one side and then either do a J-stroke or move the paddle to the other side and paddle. And you have to paddle furiously to get upstream. But at the time of retirement, or let's say at the time of restreaming, maybe you get out of that canoe and get in a kayak that has a paddle on both sides and is much more in balance. Actually, the word kayak is a palindrome. You can spell it K-A-Y-A-K both ways. And that's the same with a kayak. It's a very balanced approach, and it can deal with the whitewater, the terrors in life, in a much more balanced way, and actually play in it rather than trying to avoid them or shoot the rapids as you would in a canoe. But also a kayak can give you the flexibility, the free, open, and evolving sense of moving into the eddies every now and then and slowing down. And as you go downstream in a kayak, you can pay more attention to what's going on around you rather than trying to get somewhere. And that ties nicely into relationship, I think. And also, when I think about a kayak on a stream, if one looks at a metaphor of a stream, the longer you're alive in this wonderful world, it seems that the waters can go deeper. And perhaps even the current slows down to a point where you can actually take a deeper breath and see things in a much more intimate and a contemplative way.
Mm-hmm. And I think, Bill, I think that brings us back to pilgrimage. You know, a lot of, you know, we could travel and see sights. And I'm reminded of the scene of Chevy Chase in one of the vacation movies where they go to the Grand Canyon, and essentially he does a check mark in his guidebook that we've been here, rather than really letting the experience of being there sink in, let it wash over him a little bit. And I think there's something that in travel, and we don't have to geographically travel. We can travel from a study or wherever we are, sitting on a bench in a park. We can mentally travel, and how we can go deeper. We can go both deeper and, I think, be lifted up to higher ground. We're going to have a song about that in a bit. I think there's something. Something powerful about that, the kayak in the water going deeper. But one of your vignettes is about pilgrim people. And what does it mean to you for us to be pilgrim people?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I think we can't stop the current. We can't stop time. We're constantly moving forward. The question is, what are we doing with it? How are we being on that stream? And when we think about a pilgrimage, I'm thinking that, St. Bernard in the 11th century wrote that people journey to God not by the steps of their feet, but by the turning of their hearts. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important to know, that the change doesn't have to be from the outside. You don't have to take the via, the exotic trip to some foreign continent to get a change of heart. You can do it right there in your study, or as you take a walk around your neighborhood in Central Gardens, and just begin to think in a different way. I was thinking also, you remember the Jacques Cousteau specials?
Mm-hmm, I do.
He was scuba diving and so on. But on his ship, on Jacques Cousteau's ship, which was called the Calypso, he said, "Il faut aller voir," which means we must go and see for ourselves. And I think that sense, not just of adventure, but of curiosity, of being able to pursue questions, knowing that some of them will be unanswerable, is really what can make life exciting and interesting, but particularly when you're doing it with good people. Yeah. I recall one of my favorite lines is from Dr. Rachel Raymond, when she said her motto in life was, to pursue unanswerable questions in good company. Now I would change that just a little bit. I'd say pursue unanswerable questions with people I love and by the grace of God. Mm-hmm. But yeah. Working with relationship and that pursuit of a pilgrimage is a great combination to think about in terms of life journeys.
Yeah, the pilgrimage is not, it's not, entirely or usually isn't a solitary activity. Even if we are sitting on that park bench or in our study, God is present with us and is our companion on the journey and is seeking us as much as we are seeking God.
Right.
In that space. Bill, as part of your journey, it has taken you overseas, well, not overseas, but in this hemisphere, you've spent a lot of time in Haiti. Tell us about how you got involved with St. Vincent Center for Handicapped Children in Haiti, your involvement there, how that may have shaped you in your journey, and how did they fare during the recent earthquake?
What about the earlier earthquake, too? January of 2010, over 250,000 people died in a devastating earthquake in Port-au-Prince. And I remember driving down the street with my granddaughter at the time when I heard that on the news, and I just stopped the car and said, "Do you realize what's happening here?" It was just really astonishing. It wasn't just news of the world. There was something terrifying about this. And about 5 years later, I guess it was around 2010 or so, I was down in Haiti with a group of clergy working with the Episcopal clergy in Haiti. As a matter of fact, the Episcopal Church in Haiti is huge. There's a lot of Episcopal clergy there. And we were walking through a little school called St. Vincent's. It's a school for handicapped children in Port-au-Prince, in the very heart of the city, next to the jails, actually. And we were walking through there, and the bus was about ready to leave. There were about eight of us walking through. And I heard some singing up on the second floor of this building. And so I walked up there and peeked around the corner. And in this little classroom were 10 students and a choir master or choir director. And they were all singing in Creole, the song, "He's Got the Whole World in His Hands." But what amazed me was that everybody in that room was blind and could not see me. And I was standing almost in holy ground watching them sing in, with smiles on their faces. And I had tears in my eyes as I just watched them for a second. Then I had to, it was kind of like Moses in the burning bush. I had to leave. It was just too sacred a space. I felt like I was intruding. But then 3 or 4 years later, the bishop asked me to help develop this school and move it out into a safer neighborhood and to build it up. And so for 3 years, I was going down there 2 or 3 times a year setting up this school. And Haiti is just not just a poor country. It's just abject poverty. You know that they've had cholera. They've had mudslides, they've had hurricanes, they've had earthquakes, they have corruption. All these, I would call it the plagues, have been on Haiti. And yet, those people are beautiful. They have a sense of hope. They have a sense of a relationship with their families and with each other. They were happy faces, and it really taught me a lot over those years to work with them. The recent earthquake did not impact Port-au-Prince, and the school's doing much better, but it did devastate us. Several cities in the southwest area, in Lakaya and that area of Haiti.
And the Diocese of West Tennessee, by the way, maintains this partnership with Haiti, I think that's a very, very important partnership and a very important thing. And it just, I can tell that it's some of your experiences have really shaped you. But recently, there have been some things right here locally that you've been very moved about. Tell us about Give Back Memphis, how you, your recent story with this group.
Oh, well, Paul, about 5 years ago, this neighbor friend of mine who was a nonprofit executive and consultant in Memphis for her whole life, asked me to help develop a pro bono consulting concept to help nonprofits in the Memphis area. And so over the past 5 years, we've assisted about 60, 65 nonprofits, working with them, with people we've recruited as consultants, people who, like myself, who've retired but want purpose in life and want to give back. And so they have given of their time in providing services to these nonprofits in the areas of strategic planning, marketing, fundraising, human resources, board governance, and things like that. But it's all, we don't have a 501c3 nonprofit agency. We don't have a bank account. We don't have a location. We don't have staff. We just have a lot of people with some wonderful ideas and a real compassion to help others. And so the nonprofit community hopefully has been helped over the past 5 or 6 years with this program. And we don't really know where it's going yet. We hope it will be sustainable, but we know that every now and then you can make a difference if you just raise your hand and volunteer to do something for other people.
Wonderful, wonderful. And glad you're giving back your time and your some of your the things that you've learned over your journey. And it's a great opportunity for others to do that and talk about a purpose in retirement of giving back to organizations that are trying to make a difference in our city. That's a phenomenal work. And Bill, I wanted to kind of close our part of this or our time in just asking you this. Where are you finding hope these days?
Well, I find hope every time I see a smile on someone's face, whether it be Kroger or walking down the street. Or I think hope is implicit in everyone, but you have to bring it out. There's a lot of concerns about the pandemic and about the political problems and the other issues of climate change and so on. But at the same time, I have 7 grandchildren, and when I watch them interact with each other and with their peers and classmates, I see a lot of hope. And I think we all need to live with hope, which is different from optimism. I think hope has a much hope has a much more holistic approach to the future than just naive enthusiasm. And I think hope is what we all must have as we continue then down this journey we call life.
Oh, thank you, Bill. And great words to close out on. And I want to thank you for sharing your ongoing pilgrimage with us and for sharing and sometimes guiding those of us around you in a collective search for meaning and search for higher ground. Well, our next segment is called Stump the Priest, when I try to answer a perplexing question about faith. The question today is, does the book of Song of Solomon actually belong in the Bible? I wrestled with and preached on this question a few weeks ago. Some would argue that the Song of Solomon, or more accurately, the Song of Songs, has very little in common with any of the songs in any religious hymnal, but has almost everything in common with, say, the Reverend Al Green's secular love song, Let's Stay Together. Both never mention God. Both are beautiful ballads of romantic love. Neither seem to belong in the Bible. Or maybe there's more going on than meets the eye or the ear. Ancient scholars thought the Song of Songs was an allegory, with the lovers being metaphors for God and the Hebrew people, or for Christ and the church. Most modern commentators see it as a purely romantic ballad without all the hidden meanings. Ellen Davis, an Old Testament professor and one of our speakers at Calvary's Lenten preaching series coming up this next spring, posits a third way. She says the romantic and the religious understandings of the book are not exclusive, but mutually informative, and each is incomplete without the other. She argues that the Song of Songs is the most biblical of all the books, and she sees the love song in the context of God's passionate and troubled relationship with humanity, which is the story the rest of the Bible tells. She writes, "What we hear throughout the Song of Songs, and only hear in the Bible, is mutual love speaking at full strength. In a word, it returns us to the garden of God." And Davis asserts that it informs how we should relate to one another. She adds, "Like the love of God, profound love of another person entails devotion of the whole self and steady practice of repentance and forgiveness. It inevitably requires of us suffering and sacrifice." Al Green's inspiration for writing Let's Stay Together in the fall of 1971 came not from a lover, But out of the troubling events of that era, the assassination of Martin Luther King and the riots that followed, he said, "I sat down and wrote it. Let's stay together. What you doing? If you burn up the town, we're going to have to build it up again." From that beginning, he turned personal and just started writing about my baby. And he did all this in 15 minutes. While it's a beautiful expression of lifelong love for a romantic couple going through thick and thin, it was also Al Green's way of saying, Memphis and America, we've got to find a way to stop killing each other. We've got to find a way to talk, to listen, to build or rebuild trust, to let go of pride, to make sacrifices for one another. We've got to stay together. He and his mentor, Willie Mitchell, argued over how Al should sing it. Al wanted to sing it loud and with lots of punch. Willie said, "No, you got to whisper. You got to sing it soft. You got to let me hear Al Green." Al said, "I don't know who Al Green is." But Willie knew. Willie knew that Al Green was a man full of longing. Longing for peace and harmony in the city he loves. Longing for love, especially maternal love. Longing for God. We hear that longing in how he seems to hold that first note, that first I, for what seems like an eternity. That same deep longing that you feel when he does it comes through in the images of the Song of Songs. A gazelle, leaping, bounding, yet hidden, looking, gazing. The poet who wrote the Song of Songs knew what Willie taught Reverend Al. True longing is best expressed not in hot burning flames, but hidden in smoldering embers, gasping for air. We too pant and long for the natural images expressed by the poet in the Song of Songs. Our images today seem so unnatural. The raging of the Delta variant, uncertainties and anxiety over the start of school, scenes of the evacuation and bombing in Afghanistan, the devastation of an earthquake among our diocesan partners in Haiti, fatal flooding in the center of our state, Hurricane Ida and its after effects, a little girl last month becoming the 17th child to die in Memphis this year from the epidemic of gun violence plaguing our nation. We long for the winter to be past. We long for flowers to appear upon the earth. We long for the voice of the turtle dove to be heard in our land. But the Song of Songs and Reverend Al invite us to see that reaching this longed-for season begins with a personal connection on our part, a personal connection with God and with each other. And these personal connections will entail personal sacrifice. I wear a mask not only to protect myself, but to protect you. I get the vaccine not only to protect myself, but to protect you and our children. We can extend this mutuality of love as we think about how we live with each other in terms of caring for the environment, encouraging our educators and students, offering hospitality to refugees, helping disaster victims, and bringing an end to gun violence. Song of Songs and Reverend Al teach us that there is an inner subjectivity to our lives and that we are all in this together. The Song of Song reminds us that God longs to relish that kind of connection with us and yearns for us to relish it with each other. And God longs to end our anxieties, to fill us with hope, and to inspire us to be that hope. Thanks to Bill Craddock, our guest, and to each of you for joining us. You are also invited to join us at Calvary Episcopal Church tomorrow, Friday night, September 17th, when our Friends of Music host, Gavin Wigginson, concert choir director and instructor of applied voice at Lemoyne Owen College and fellowship coach with the Memphis Music Initiative. He will present a program entitled Spiritual Reflections, looking at the relationship between African-American spirituals and social justice. The program begins at 7:30 in the church with a reception taking place beforehand in the Great Hall at 6:30. Hope you will join us. The program will also be live streamed on calvarymemphis.org and the Calvary Episcopal Church Memphis Facebook page. Please also remember to find the Episcopal Diocese of West Tennessee on Facebook, Instagram, and at edwtn.org. You can listen to past episodes of Faithfully Memphis on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. Please like and subscribe. This is Reverend Paul McLean for Faithfully Memphis. Until next time, stay safe and stay positive.